Hello, and welcome to Learning English Weekend, the Sunday edition. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz in Washington. It's May 29th, 2016. It was on this day in 1990 that the Russian Parliament elected Boris Yeltsin president. Now, here's what's ahead on today's program. In our weekly higher education report, Pete Musto tells us about the trend in recent years for more financial aid to be given to high-income students rather than low-income students. Even though the low-income students have a greater need, schools want to reward students with better grades. Then, Anna Mateo will be with us, as she is every Sunday, with Words and Their Stories. This week, she will tell us about the many American English expressions that use the word book. I think you should book some time in your busy schedule to listen to her report. And, as we always do on the Sunday edition of Learning English Weekend, we will present The Making of a Nation. This week in our series, we will tell you about President Calvin Coolidge. He became the country's leader following the unexpected death of Warren Harding. Coolidge took office during a time when some top officials were facing charges of corruption. So you can see, as always, we have a lot for you today. We're on the radio, on the web, and we come to you on a podcast. We are wherever you are. We're the Voice of America. Now, as we do every Sunday, we tell you what is happening in American higher education. This week, education reporter Pete Musto tells us about where financial aid is going. Financial aid is an important resource for students who want to attend college in the United States but don't have enough money. Financial aid is offered by banks, the government, and the school a student plans to attend. But as Pete tells us, research shows the amount of financial aid that colleges and universities provide low-income students has decreased.
The National Center for Education Statistics, or NCES, collects information about education across the country. Last year, the NCES, a part of the Department of Education, reported that more than 41% of all full-time students attending college for the first time in 2014 received financial aid from their school. But the NCES report also shows the average amount of institutional aid for low-income students has decreased steadily from 1996 to 2012. The average amount of institutional aid given to the lowest-income students was $2,540 in 1996. The average amount given to the highest-income students was $3,327 in the same year. That indicates that students with the greatest need received less financial aid than higher-income students. In 2012, low-income students received an average of $5,300, while high-income students received an average of $7,800. Again, the students with the greatest need received less financial aid than higher-income students. Ben Miller is the Senior Director for Post-Secondary Education at the Center for American Progress, an organization that studies and reports on American society. Miller says the problem goes back earlier than 1996. He says the problem is colleges want to look better in rankings like the U.S. News and World Report, a media company that creates a list of what it calls America's best colleges. The company bases the list on information like the average standardized test results of a school's students. A college with higher average test results has a better chance of being higher on U.S. News and World Report's list. Miller says higher income students usually have higher test results and grade averages. Schools have begun to use their institutional aid to try to appeal to those types of students. When schools take students with better academic records and are able to turn other students away, they look more prestigious, he says.
The problem is we haven't come up with a good way to evaluate colleges on meaningful things. You can't go out there and find out, what's the college where I'm going to learn the most? Or what's the college where I'm going to get the most skills for my money that's going to be my best value? And so instead, we use a lot of things that we think might represent quality and value, but really don't necessarily.
The College Board lists the average cost of universities in the U.S. They looked at the average cost for residents to attend a public four-year institution in their state. They found the cost was $9,410 for the 2015-2016 academic year. The average cost for a private four-year institution was $32,405 for the same year. The U.S. government spent about $31.5 billion on Pell Grants in the 2013-2014 academic year. The Pell Grant program is the main source of federal financial aid. The government has offered Pell Grants since 1972. But Andrew Nichols says that federal financial aid alone is not enough to help low-income students. Nichols is the Director for Higher Education Research and Data Analytics at the Education Trust, an organization that fights for equal access to education for all people. Nichols helped write a report in 2015 on some of the problems low-income students face. This report said half the students using Pell Grants received a bachelor's degree within 6 years. About 65% of students who did not use Pell Grants received a degree in the same amount of time. This does not mean that students with more money are smarter, Nichols says. Working more than 15 hours a week can cause students to perform poorly in the classroom.
So you don't have enough aid, so you need to work. And then when you start working, it takes away from your ability to focus on your studies. And then when that happens, you could possibly lose your scholarship, which could mean that you have less money. And so it's kind of a very ugly cycle that some students can get in.
Nichols adds that a lot of African American, Latino, and first generation students are often low income as well. These communities are often underserved. I'm Pete Musto.
Thanks, Pete. Now, if it's Sunday, it's time for Ana Mateo and Words and Their Stories, one of our most popular programs. Today, she tells us just a few of the many ways speakers of American English use the word book.
Now, the VOA Learning English Program, Words and Their Stories. When you learn a foreign language, it can be very difficult to know the best word to use in a situation. This show can help you learn how and when to use American expressions. Today, we will explore a seemingly simple word, book. Everyone knows what a book is. We read books to get information. We read books for stories. A book can be like a time machine that takes a reader on a trip into the past or future. People who love to read and love books are called bookworms. Like the actual insects that feed on the pages and paste of books, bookworms eat up every word on the printed page. Even with the invention of electronic books, or e-books, book lovers are still called bookworms. Besides pages and paste, a book is made up of several parts. Let's begin with what we usually see first, the cover. In American English, we like to say, "Do not judge a book by its cover." This means you should not judge something or someone simply by how it looks on the outside. The cover of a book may look appealing, but that does not mean the inside is well written. This expression is usually used with people. Another part of a book is the page. If we say a book is a real page-turner, it means it is very well written and very suspenseful. You cannot wait to turn the page to find out what happens next. However, to turn the page means something different. This means to stop thinking or dealing with something unpleasant. A chapter is also part of a book. It can also mean a part of history or a person's life. Sometimes these two are used together, as in this example. It is time to turn the page on that dark chapter in history. This can also be used in a personal example. She needed to turn the page on the sad chapter in her life. Instead of turning the page or starting a new chapter, you can be on the same page with someone. To be on the same page means you agree about something. It is as if the two of you are reading from the same book and have stopped at the same place. When you do stop reading in a book, especially a borrowed book, you may want to think twice before dog-earing the page to mark your spot. To dog-ear the page of a book means to bend the top corner slightly, like a dog's ear. And this upsets many book lovers. So do not dog-ear someone else's book, and definitely do not tear a page out of it, except if you are using the idiom. Taking a page out of someone's book means to do something they would do. This can be used for people or for organizations. For example, some people feel the government should take a page out of the private sector's book and operate more efficiently. Besides reading books, did you know you can also read people? To read someone like a book means you are able to understand someone very clearly. It is easy to read someone like a book when they are an open book. A person who is an open book shares their thoughts and shows their feelings very easily. A closed book is the opposite. It describes something that is difficult to understand or a person who does not share personal details. This expression can also mean something that has completely ended. For example, if you have a friend who went through a difficult divorce, you could say her marriage is a closed book, and one she does not want to read again. All this opening and closing of books makes me think of studying. Students facing a tough exam must hit the books. This sounds violent, but it simply means to study long and hard. No one has to physically attack the books, although, after hours and hours of studying, a student may want to. Now, let's listen to some of these expressions in a conversation.
What are you doing this weekend?
Richard and I are hitting the books. We need to study for the big exam.
Richard, the new student? He's always so cheery. He must have a really easy life.
You should not judge a book by its cover. I've known Richard a long time, and actually, he has had a really rough year.
Really? I'm surprised to hear that. He is always smiling and is so pleasant with everyone.
He has always been a bit of a closed book. He never talks about his personal life, especially the bad times.
I should take a page out of Richard's book and be happy even when times are tough.
We're on the same page there. I'm trying to keep a good attitude, too. But he said that he's finally turned the page on a difficult chapter in his life.
Glad to hear it. He seems like a really nice guy.
And now it's time for us to turn the page and end this chapter of Words and Their Stories. But join us again next time as we talk more about words and expressions in American English. I'm Anna Mateo.
There's so many books to choose. Get on board, you just can't.
Now, as we do every Sunday, we present The Making of a Nation. This week in our series, Steve Ember and Shirley Griffith tell us about Calvin Coolidge and how he became President of the United States. The early 1920s were a troubled time for America. Congress and the public began to discover crimes by several officials in the administration of President Warren Harding. Harding became seriously ill during a trip to Alaska and the western states. He died in a hotel room in California in August 1923. Harding's vice president, Calvin Coolidge, became president. Both men were Republicans. Their policies on issues were much the same. But Coolidge was a very different man. He was completely honest. He was the kind of president the country needed to rebuild trust in the government.
Calvin Coolidge was quiet and plain-looking. He was the son of a farmer and political leader from the small northeastern state of Vermont. Young Calvin worked at different jobs to pay for his college education. He became a lawyer. He moved to another northeastern state, Massachusetts, where he became active in Republican Party politics. First, he was elected mayor of the town. Then he was elected to the state legislature. Finally, he was elected governor of Massachusetts. It was as governor that Coolidge first became known throughout the United States.
In 1919, a group of policemen in the city of Boston tried to start a labor union. This violated the rules of the police department. So the commissioner of police suspended 19 of the union's leaders. The next day, almost 75% of Boston's policemen went on strike. Criminals walked freely through the city for 2 nights. They robbed stores and threatened public safety. Frightened Americans all across the country waited to see what Governor Coolidge would do.
He took strong action. He called on state troops to end the strike. He said, "There is no right to strike against the public safety by anybody, anywhere, anytime." most Americans approved of what Coolidge did. The people of Massachusetts supported him, too. They re-elected him governor by a large number of votes. Then, in 1920, Republicans nominated Warren Harding for president. They nominated Calvin Coolidge for vice president. When President Harding died in California, Coolidge, his wife, and two sons moved to the White House.
America's 30th president was, in some ways, an unusual kind of person to lead the country. He said little. He showed few feelings. Coolidge's policies as president were not active. He tried to start as few new programs as possible. He was a conservative Republican who believed deeply that government should be small. Coolidge expressed his belief this way: if the federal government should go out of existence, most people would not note the difference. And once, he said, 4/5 of our troubles in this life would disappear if we would only sit down and keep still.
Coolidge believed that private business, not the federal government, should lead the country to greater wealth and happiness. He continued President Harding's policy of supporting American business both inside the United States and in other countries. The government, under President Coolidge, continued high taxes on imports in an effort to help American companies.
Many Americans shared Coolidge's ideas about small government and big business. In the early 1920s, many of them were living better than ever before. At that time, companies were growing larger. The prices of their stocks rose higher and higher. There were lots of jobs, and the wages of many workers increased. Americans agreed with their president that there was little need for government spending and government programs when private industry seemed so strong.
The American economy grew in the 1920s for several reasons. The World War had destroyed many factories and businesses in Europe. The United States did not suffer the same destruction. It was still a young country. It had great natural resources, trained workers, and a huge market within its own borders. When peace came, Americans found their economy stronger than any other in the world.
Changes in the American market also helped economic growth. Installment buying became popular. In this system, people could buy a product and pay for it over a period of several weeks or months. The total cost was higher because they had to pay interest. But the system made it possible for more people to buy more goods. It also made the idea of borrowing money more acceptable to many Americans.
The growing importance of the New York stock markets also helped economic growth in the 1920s. Millions of Americans bought shares of stock in companies that seemed to grow bigger every month. Such investment almost became a national game. People would buy shares of stock, then sell them when the stock rose in value. There were many stories of poor people who became rich overnight by buying the right stocks. The American Congress also helped the economy by lowering income taxes. People had more money to spend on new goods. Another important reason for economic growth was a change in the way American companies were operated.
During the 1920s, the idea of manufacturing goods in the most scientific way became very popular. The father of this idea of scientific management was an engineer, Frederick Taylor. Mr. Taylor developed a system to study manufacturing. He studied each machine involved in the process. He studied how much work each person did. He studied how goods moved from one part of a factory to another. Then he offered ideas to business owners about ways to produce goods faster and for less cost.
Taylor's ideas of scientific management appealed to business owners. Automobile manufacturer Henry Ford proved that the ideas could work in his new car factory in the state of Michigan. Ford used the assembly line system of production. In this system, each worker did one thing to a product as it moved through the factory. This helped cut prices and increase wages.
Ford and other businessmen learned a great deal about how to control costs, set prices, and decide how much to produce. All these changes in production and marketing helped Ford and other American companies grow larger and stronger. Henry Ford's Model T car became popular throughout the country. So did other new products: radios, refrigerators for cooling food, vacuums to clean carpets, ready-made cigarettes, beauty products. Americans in the 1920s began to buy all kinds of new products they had never used before.
Calvin Coolidge was in the White House. However, business led the nation. Times were good. Americans trusted business and its leaders. It became an honor to call someone a businessman. Colleges organized business classes. Middle-class citizens in almost every city and town gathered to discuss business ideas. President Coolidge spoke for millions of Americans when he said, "The chief business of the American people is business."
Coolidge represented traditional values and the simple way of life. He knew exactly how every dollar he earned was saved or spent. And he spent no more money than was necessary. The strange thing was that Coolidge was extremely popular with a public that was spending large amounts of money. Some economic experts warned that the country's quick economic growth would end in depression. Most Americans, however, believed that the good times had come to stay. They enjoyed the good things in life that work and success in business could bring. The economic growth of the 1920s brought exciting changes to the day-to-day life of millions of Americans. Those changes will be the subject of our Making of a Nation program next week on Learning English Weekend, the Sunday edition. You can read and listen to all of the stories that you have just heard on this program on our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. And that's Learning English Weekend, the Sunday edition. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz, reporting from Washington. For all of us here at VOA Learning English, thanks for spending some time with us today.